KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the co-editors as well as authors, co-authors, of the book The Offensive Internet, Speech, Privacy, and Reputation. Professor Saul Lovemore and Martha Nussbaum are joining us today as the editors and also contributors to this volume, focusing on, as the subtitle suggests, speech, privacy, and reputation from ultimately, broadly from a harm standpoint, as well as from a fundamental question of what the risks are associated with using the internet in 2010-2011. This show, Hearsay Culture, has had a number of guests on over the last several years, and indeed since its founding, focusing on each of these issues. The speech issues have been a heavy focus on Hearsay Culture, directly related to how the internet has grown and developed. Our discussions of copyright issues and the commons, for example, have been a major focus of the show, and indeed we're going to have some of that discussion today. Privacy has also been a heavy focus of the show, whether discussing that with Dan Solov or others recently. We have continually attempted to figure out where those lines are drawn and how we can classify privacy harms, for example, in conversation that we had with Ryan Kahlo not too long ago. And reputation is a broad issue that we discuss in the context of trademark, more specifically on the intellectual property side, but also more broadly, again, in the realm of social media and how people build their reputations or destroy them using the internet, and how ultimately they can be harmed. So in our discussion today, our conversation with Martha and Saul, we're going to have a fairly wide-ranging discussion focusing on their views of a variety of issues, from anonymity to issues involving Section 230, and ultimately where the internet is headed. Now, I don't generally ask the crystal ball questions, but we may at least get into a general discussion of where Martha and Saul see the internet being today. So I'm very excited to have them on. Saul, and many listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with both Saul and Martha's background, but very briefly, Saul, former dean at the University of Chicago, as well as the William B. Graham Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Martha Nussbaum is the Ernst Friend Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, and with Amartya Sen, a founding president of the Human Development and Capability Association. Both obviously are prolific and extremely well-regarded and well-known scholars in their fields, including these, and so I'm very honored and excited to have both of them on today, joining me from Saul's office at the University of Chicago. Martha and Saul, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much, Dave. It's really great to be on the program.
Nice to be here, and come visit us in person one day.
I look forward to it. Thank you. Let's start off, and Martha, perhaps I'll start with you asking about the genesis of your interest in this project. How did you become interested in putting this this volume together?
Well, you know, neither of us is a real expert in this area, although Saul now has moved into it more. But what happened was that we were concerned by some harassing and bullying of women that pertained particularly to law schools and law students. There was this site called Auto Admit that purported to give advice about law school admissions, and very quickly it became a site where named female law students were humiliated, were made the target of pornographic narratives with their names and physical appearance details attached, or were made the topic of threats of a sexual nature. And all of this was clearly done by men who had seen them, because they described them, and men presumably in their law school classes, and yet it pertained to lots of different law schools all over the country. No one had any idea who was running the site or where it was run from. And so what was happening was that these women were powerless, their careers were being damaged. The site even gave advice about how to get your pornographic story about Jane Doe so-and-so onto the first page of Google under that woman's name. So when these women went to apply for jobs in firms, they would Google their name and this stuff would come up. Even if the firm didn't believe it, they just shrank back. The woman was tainted. And so there was a long search trying to find out where this site was run from. Eventually, they did unmask the person who ran it, who was a law student at the University of Pennsylvania. But the people who posted on it couldn't be identified. So it was the anonymity combined with the fact that website owners and providers are immunized from legal liability under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It made it very, very difficult for these women to bring suits for defamation. They did try. In fact, two of them, Yale law students, did sue, but they had to sue pseudonyms. So it was like Jane Doe against Spanky and against, quote, Brian Leiter, end quote, because Brian, our colleague, whom we'll talk about later, was actually one of the people who had helped unmask the site and the people who ran it. And so they, in revenge, borrowed his name as a pseudonym for one of the posters. So anyway, these women were suing pseudonyms. And so even if they won the suit, they couldn't recover. So we were worried about this. The traditional torts were just useless in this world of internet anonymity. So we thought that it would be a good idea to have a conference about this problem. And we thought it would be good for it to be an interdisciplinary conference and to get law people from a wide range of perspectives, not all of them internet experts, but also to get some philosophers. So we had me and Brian Leiter, but we also had John Dee, another philosopher. And so we wanted to put together the insights of philosophy and a range of areas of law, including free speech law, and just see where we were with this issue. Now I think I'll turn it over to Saul, and he can say more.
Well, I'll imagine that you're asking me, Dave, about the origin of my interest in it.
Yes, correct.
I think it comes from two perspectives, and they are conflicting perspectives, but I'm happy to be a person in tension. I mean, one is that I'm a private law person, basically. I never really understand constitutional law people. I'll go every morning for coffee at a local coffee shop. It's in the private sphere in the sense that somebody owns the coffee shop. It never occurs to us that there'd be some unlimited First Amendment inside the coffee shop. If you vandalize the coffee shop, if you write Jane Doe is a slut on the back of your booth in this coffee shop, which I might add a lot of people do, then, you know, the coffee shop owner can get you or can throw you out of the coffee shop or could even sue you in tort for defacing the wooden material there. And in fact, if you write Jane Doe is a slut there and you write very specific things about, say, a local student or something, and the landlord does not take down this graffiti, there are cases holding the landlord responsible, especially after the landlord is put on notice by Jane Doe or her friends. You know, this is harming me, this is defaming me, you're helping this along. And that seems to us a very, meaning I think most of society, a very reasonable state of affairs, that in private space there are limits about the harm that we can do to one another and there are limits to our intermediation of First Amendment rights and so forth. So I was very interested in these sort of modern claims that, oh, the internet is different. I tend to rebel against claims of exceptionalism. And then somehow that's the public square, rah, rah, everything's okay in the public square. You know, most of my life and most of your life does not take place in the public square. It's not obvious to me why the internet should be so put in one rather than the other. But then I said there's some tension, and the tension is the following, and now I'll give you a personal confession, which is not only have I written about anonymity in the past, that's not the important thing, but I have a long history of sending anonymous notes and letters and of receiving them. My sister used to go up and down the block leaving people anonymous notes about how horrible their dogs were or how sloppy their yards were or something of the sort. And I think, you know, properly thought about, anonymity has a role. You might know that my child is in danger or that my child, say, uses drugs with bad sorts. And you might be afraid to tell me about it. I mean, we just met, and on the radio, no less. And you might think that I'll really think badly of you and tell you to mind my own business, but in my situation, you might want to know. If you ever learn that, please send me a note. If it makes you feel better to be anonymous, go ahead. And so there's a part of me that thinks that anonymity is very valuable. Anonymity is a tool, and yet there's a part of me, along with Martha's sense of this, that thinks that anonymity is a danger. And that got me very interested in these topics.
And yeah, it's fascinating. Both of you mentioned this, and perhaps I'll ask this question up front. I thought I might get to it later, but I'll ask it now. You know, your former colleague Larry Lessig and your current colleague Judge Easterbrook, you know, of course, engage in a very famous and bedrock debate on the existence of cyber law in an article and a response that many listeners are familiar with, and I know you are. And I'm curious, you know, up front, as you enter into this project of working with eminent people in the field to write about the internet, what your views are right now in terms of cyber law and intranet law as a field. Given your perspectives and the concerns that both of you raise as being the genesis for your interest here, what's your reaction? Perhaps I'll start with you, Saul, and then we'll continue with Martha.
Well, I have one answer as a teacher and another answer as a citizen. So first, as a teacher, I would say whether or not cyber law is an area of its own, sort of like Frank Easterbrook's law of the horse, I mean, whether or not horse law is really any different, it is not quite the point to the teacher and me. It's more, well, if it interests citizens and if it interests students, then let's just make believe it's a subject on its own. I can teach many, many things in an area of law that students are interested in that they might not have thought they were interested in. So if they're all gravitating towards, you know, international law because they think it's cool to be global and wear, you know, all black clothes in Greenwich Village and it makes them feel cosmopolitan, then that's fine with me. Then I'll teach them commercial transactions in an international guise and anything to inspire people. If I lived in Kentucky, I would probably be the first person to teach horse law because people there are really interested in horses. And if that's how they're going to learn about good faith purchases or free speech or insanity defenses or tort law, that's just fine with me. Now, as a citizen or a student of the world, you know, I think that both sides are wrong. I mean, as usual, I think extremes are wrong. Mm-hmm. There is some law that is unique to cyberspace, and therefore there is such a thing as cyberspace law. We might want to have different free rider problem reactions. We might have different copyright laws. The marginal cost of digital transmission is zero. That makes it a little bit different from books. So when I teach copyright law, digital rights managements are different in cyberspace than they are elsewhere. I think it's a little bit foolish to make believe that this is all things we've seen before. Tis, tis, there's nothing new under the sun. On the other hand, you know, I think to imagine that the whole world is a new place now that the internet exists and, oh, this generation has nothing to learn from previous generations in law or elsewhere because it exists on its smartphones, I mean, that's also silly. Probably 95% of the problems in cyberspace have been seen elsewhere and we can learn from them elsewhere.
I'm going to say something different about this field. I knew nothing about this field when I organized the conference, partly because I'm technologically a real Luddite. I'm always the last person to learn to use any new thing and so on. I only just got Skype about a month ago. So, you know, what I felt was that this field is very narrow because it's mostly male and it doesn't have much of a feminist presence. And so there's this notion of freedom and of free speech, which is quite a libertarian notion of free speech, which is not sensitive enough to harms of the sort that women actually experience when they're objectified on the internet. And so one of the main aims of the volume is to bring feminism into this area of scholarship. And I think people in the field really, really need to stretch their imaginations. When I saw the movie The Social Network, I have to confess, so I work in development economics, and there's this mm-hmm. tripartite division of countries where high human development, medium human development, and low human development. And I sometimes find myself using that as a division of people. And I felt that all the characters in The Social Network were people of low human development, meaning that they just didn't have much of an ability to imagine the situation of another person. And then that kind of teenage boy conception of what freedom consists in was informing the way the whole field evolved. And I think there's some truth to that. Not entirely true, obviously, but so we wanted to bring in debates about freedom that come from a much wider range of perspectives. And so the philosophers in the volume are all talking about free speech, and they have a range of different positions, but for the most part, they're trying to point out that the leading philosophical theories of free speech from John Stuart Mill's On Liberty on are really very critical of harmful speech and do not defend what is usually known as low-value speech, not political speech and not artistic speech, but just speech of a kind that defames or harms other people. And somehow in this internet field, a much broader range of types of speech has been protected in ways that I feel are not altogether helpful and often quite harmful to women.
We're chatting with Professors Saul Levmore and Martha Nussbaum on Hearsay Culture in KZSU FM Stanford. We are recording on December 1st. Let me ask this question of you, Martha, which I think gets to these issues, but also the way that you've structured the volume. And I'm curious, as I went through the names and read through the book, a number of the authors in this volume have been on Hearsay Culture: Dan Sulov, Daniel Citron, Cass Sunstein, Frank Pasquale, and others who I want to have on. How did you go about selecting the authors to contribute here? Because you definitely have, in my view, a wide range of perspectives on technology and the internet represented here. Did you have any particular theory or operating principle in mind?
Well, of course, I relied a lot on the advice of my colleagues about who is good to ask in this area, because I don't know the area, but I wanted to make sure that enough philosophers were there and that people with different views of free speech were there. So Jeff Stone presents a very traditional kind of absolutist version of the First Amendment, but then Brian Leiter and John Dee present a very different account. And so I wanted people to see that debates about free speech go in many different directions. I also wanted to make sure that feminism was amply represented. So Brian Leiter's paper has a strong feminist aspect, Danielle's paper also. And then my own paper is really not about law at all. It's about philosophical issues in feminism. I talk about the feminist conception of objectification, treating a person as a mere object for your use and control. And I talk about how that concept seems to apply in this area where there's suddenly this new way in which people can take people's identities and their very selfhood, and they can just use those as objects for their enjoyment, their titillation, their revenge. And so I then say what particularly happens is something that seems to me to be very like what Nietzsche is talking about when he talks about the idea of ressentiment. That is a group that feels powerless, gets power by creating a whole world in fantasy in which other people are subordinate. And so that, of course, can happen in real life, but it can happen in spades in the internet, because it is this virtual world that's relatively immune to the incursions of reality. And so here were these guys, these male law students, who did turn out to be people who were not very successful, were the ones that were unmasked. And they're anxious because suddenly women have poured into this world and are taking jobs that they might have otherwise gotten. And they create a whole world in which these women all of a sudden are not threats, are not powerful, but they're just these pathetic protagonists of a pornographic story, and they can control them, and they can imagine raping them, and they can imagine defiling them, and then, of course, they end up doing real damage in the real world as a result of those narratives. So anyway, I was really keen to have that kind of discussion out there so that we could think what the legal consequences of that might be.
So let me say something on behalf of the defilers of the world. I'm sorry, on behalf of the men of the world. One of the interesting, I agree with everything Martha said, and yet, one of the interesting things we found when we come across readers of our book, especially the younger readers, and as many women as men, is that some of them think we're prudish in a way, or they haven't yet experienced what it's like to be defiled, you might say, optimistically. And so we at first were a little taken aback. Like people would say, oh, come on. Women who would say, oh, come on. I blow off steam all the time. And I get on the internet and I say my boss is an effing so-and-so. And this guy in my class has a, you know, tiny little D word and a this and a that. And I just love saying really horrible, obnoxious things about people. And you know what? I don't mind when people call me a slut and they call me a this and call me a that. You know, I mean, it's part of the fun. This is my playground. And stop taking yourselves and your language so seriously. It's like, you know, junior high school students throwing around words that, you know, you adults think of as homophobic or racist or sexist. But, you know, when they're in eighth and ninth grade, they just use these words off the top of their heads, and stop constraining them in this way. And at first, it's a little bit like going to a hockey game or something where people are screaming things out at the referee and the players on the ice from the opposing team. And if you're a civilized person, you think, my God. But, you know, we know enough not to think, well, there should be a law against this. We just think, well, there are some people that blow off steam in this way. And I guess as this audience would say, as long as the referee sort of knows what he or she is getting into by going out there on the ice, you know, maybe there's no great harm done.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a part of me that thinks, well, that's fine if there's some shared playground where people want to go hurling these insults at each other, fine. But, of course, that's just not the internet. I mean, you can get defiled even if you choose not to be in the playground. And even the first person we ran into was very articulate about this. Turns out that a lot of the ways she blows off steam is she badmouths businesses. She sort of goes to her store and she doesn't like her old Toyota and they don't do a good job repairing her car. And she just gets up on the internet and tells everybody within a 100-mile radius how that store stole from her and raped her car and did this and did that. And she makes the store out to be, you know, 1,000 times worse than it really is. Or sometimes she confesses she hasn't even been to that store. She just picks some piece of corporate America and rails against it. We would never allow this in traditional tort law. I don't really see any reason why we should allow it on the internet. And yet, I think it's an interesting problem because it's not just like tort law in the sense that for some people it is their playground. And partly that's what makes it interesting, I think.
Yeah, and I think Saul is absolutely right that these women that we're talking about, the ones who were defamed in auto admit, did not choose to participate in that. That wasn't their playtime. They were just trying to be law students, and they were dragooned into this. Now, of course, we're all vulnerable to that, and some sites are very good at self-policing. I think Wikipedia is unusually responsible and good, because if you point out that on your Wikipedia page there's something false or irresponsible, they will flag it, and they'll put up a notice, and you know, if you can correct it or somebody else can correct it, but also if it keeps being posted again, they will put up a notice on the site saying that there's dispute and there's probably inaccuracies on this site. And so I think that's a good kind of self-policing, but many sites don't do the self-policing. And so we're worried about what happens then when this defamation goes on and the self-policing isn't working. Shouldn't law and regulation take a hand?
I mean, I have the same intuition. I think that is how law will develop. But I'm open-minded about the future. I mean, it is quite possible that the generation that follows us will be much more into the playground thing than we think. It's quite possible that, you know, a whole generation will develop with very thick skin on the internet, and they will just think, you know, it's just not a big deal if you get defamed. Much as maybe eighth graders in some world I've never been in don't mind if graffiti is put on them in the back of booths in the coffee shop. I don't think we've ever seen that world where people have very, very thick skins. But I understand that the internet might, you know, if you go through Facebook, you can see, if I go through my children's Facebook pages and their friends, I can see that they seem to think that they and their friends have pretty thick skins. They say things about each other that we as adults wouldn't say about each other. And maybe they'll develop a different sensibility and we'll have a much broader view of the playground. Again, I don't think we're there yet. In fact, judging from the classroom, I would say the generation present in universities is much more sensitive than the generation before. Teachers work with a much softer hand. You don't grill students the way they used to. You never call them names. I mean, 40 years ago, if we look at movies, you would have said to a teacher, you would have said to a student, oh, come on, that's a stupid comment. You could do better than that. If you said that now, they would practically drum you out of the university. You can't call students stupid. It would interfere with their fragile ego. So I doubt that people are really better at being called sluts than they were before, though it is possible that everyone will develop, you know, some pachydermic sense.
And one of the things that Danielle points out is that this is a civil rights violation. I mean, there is a new sensitivity to defamation that takes the form of targeting people of a certain race or a certain gender. And she's arguing that rather than just using the traditional tort, we should use civil rights law in order to signal the fact that a lot of the harassment that takes place on the internet does take the form of targeting people on the basis of racial or gender characteristics. And I think Saul is absolutely right that we're much more sensitive to that than we used to be. But I also think that we are still people who cherish privacy. Jeff Stone, at the end of his free speech article, says, basically, this is a new world, there's no more privacy, get used to it. But I don't think people are there. And we can see with the debates about privacy violations on Facebook that people are very, very upset that some of the privacy norms were not what they thought they were. And so I think we really have to think what we want the future of privacy to be like, and, as I say, the future of civil rights and equality.
I mean, one way to think about that is that there is room on the internet, as elsewhere, for a playground for those people on both sides of the transaction who want to live by looser rules of the game. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you defame me on Wikipedia, it's easy to get Wikipedia to follow a notice and take down policy, even though they don't necessarily have to follow that. They do by implicit contract. The same is true, say, of our law school website or even course evaluations. If a student writes something horrific about a teacher full of four-letter words, the law school feels free not to include that in the course evaluations that are transmitted to future law students. And so that makes people comfortable both to speak and to be spoken about. Now, it is possible that outside of Facebook, that is in small corners of the internet, people who like to revile one another might get together and agree to let off steam there and call each other horrible names. A little bit, I guess, like the hockey rink, if you will. I think that's fine. You know, it might, especially because those are generally non-searchable databases right now. If your future employer wants to look up Dave Levine, they don't immediately go to this hockey rink and find out that people screamed at you when you were on the ice.
Right.
And there are things that are excluded from these searchable databases. In an ironic kind of way, technology is the enemy of free speech here. Because if the technology of searching would stay Neanderthal-like, that is, if Facebook remained generally hard to search, if these fringe sites remain hard to search, that would give more room for people who want the playground. It's a little bit hard for me to see why that part of the population that really wants to let off steam has to scream at these Yale women law students who don't participate in the, you know, who don't voluntarily participate in the playground. Nor should they scream at the tire dealer or the car manufacturer that's not interested in being screamed at. There are plenty of people who want to hate and be hated. They can all get together and scream at each other, as on the hockey rink, and I guess I'm comfortable.
But even the world of the hockey rink, I mean, there's actually a hilarious debate in the Chicago Tribune about the hockey rink, because a mother wrote to the advice columnist saying, I took my two children to the hockey rink and they heard all this foul language. What should I have done? And now everyone is debating this. And, well, the advice person said, well, you know, you could ask them not to do it, but if they ignore you, then just tell your kids, you know, what goes on in hockey stays in hockey, and that's it's a different world, but you don't take that home. And everyone is furious with her because they think that she's encouraging swearing. She's doing all kinds of terrible things. So,
and being unlibertarian. I mean, she doesn't have to go to the hockey game. That's or right. Maybe there'll be an alternative league called clean hockey.
Right.
Well, actually, quite a lot of people say that those guys who are using the swear word should have been ejected. That is quite comical. But anyway, that is a position. So, you know, we have to figure out what we want. But I agree with Saul that if you don't want to participate in that, your identity shouldn't become endeared. I found out yesterday that there had been a Facebook page of me. I'm not on Facebook. I just don't want to be on Facebook. But for a long time, apparently, there was a Facebook page of me. People sent friend requests and were surprised that there was no response. But it was created, I think, by the former student who follows me quite closely. But anyway, it was just terrible to think that my identity had been commandeered and everyone thought that this was a site about me. I had no knowledge of it at all.
Although you might have been better off never knowing.
Yeah, probably.
Right. And to the extent that the terms on Facebook were violated, that's a separate way to handle it as well. Before we go on, at this point, Saul and Martha, quickly let me mention that you're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University. It requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on donate. Either way, I hope you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture as well as KZSU. You know, Saul and Martha, as I'm listening to what you were saying, you know, the to the extent that there is an age-old debate in cyber law itself, and it's something that we talk about somewhat frequently, although we don't address it directly, is this difference, as both of you have mentioned, between the physical world and this virtual world. And one of the hallmark questions you know, that come up in the context of cyber law is whether that physical attribute matters. Being able to walk into a bar and have an argument or get threatened and then physically leave and diminish the threat versus, as both of you have pointed out, the permanence of the internet, the permanence of speech, and how technology keeps that speech present. And I'm curious whether you think that that at the core is your concern, as both of you have expressed, not only in your contributions in the offensive internet, but indeed other authors have mentioned, this difference between physical and virtual, or permanent and erasable, as it were.
Well, I mean, one of the things, the permanence is one difference, but there's also this fact that it goes everywhere and it's insulated, therefore, from contact with the physical world, which doesn't go everywhere. So in the physical world, if this law student is defamed by her classmates, she will quickly correct that by just being who she is. She'll say something smart, she'll get good grades, etc. People will come to know what Jane Doe is really like. But in the cyberspace world, when this story about Jane Doe is spread all over the world, there's no way that her reality can countermand that and can create a different picture of her. She can't go everywhere in the world and say, that's not who I am. You know, and so that's one of the things that disturbed me.
I'm not smitten with the physical-virtual distinction, and let me say why. I think it starts by not knowing which way it cuts. I mean, the suggestion of permanence is that we need to control speech more in the virtual world because mm-hmm. it's obviously permanent.
Right.
Whereas when you walk into the bar, it would only be permanent if somebody were recording it and so forth, which mm-hmm. could even be against local law. On the other hand, in the bar, there's the threat of imminent physical danger from people's speech getting out of hand, call somebody a bad name, they might have a temper tantrum. So if there were a physical virtual distinction that was worth really dwelling on in law, I'm really not sure where we would want more free speech. By free speech here, I mean really loose speech.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a distinction that I want to put too much on. Also, I'm kind of into free speech from another direction here. So it's true that someone can badmouth me on the internet, and I don't even know who heard it, and they can say terrible things, as they have. On the other hand, they can also say nice things about me on the internet, and the word can spread. Now, I know this is not much comfort to the Yale women that are defiled, but in some ex-ante sense, I mean, I'm kind of a law and economics person. If you said to me beforehand, would you rather a rule where people could talk about you behind your back, where you could control the speech, or would you rather a world where they could say whatever they want behind your back and you didn't have to know about it? I think I would take the latter world. I would think, well, you know, people might say falsehoods about me that really harm me, but they might also say, believe me, I've been complimented very often when I don't deserve it. So people might run around saying what a great guy I am, or, you know, what a fine teacher I am, when I didn't have a very good day in the classroom. Perhaps they want to curry favor with me. Perhaps they're bad judges of character. Perhaps they're trying to badmouth somebody else to make me look good by comparison. It's not obvious to me that false speech about me is, on average, doing me more harm than it's doing me good. And forced to choose beforehand, I might prefer a world of free speech, because after all, if everybody knows, that if the listeners know that all the speech is vetoed by me or vetoable by me, then they won't think the compliments are worth very much. So wanting these compliments, if you were wanting flattery of my business, wanting people to spread around word about how well I repair cars, I might be happy to run the risk that people will also badmouth the cars. So I think it's actually a very complicated question. Now, nevertheless, our norm seems to be that we're worried about the fringe cases, the extreme cases of the harm. Someone might really have it in for me and defame me. Somebody really might have it in for me and badmouth my business. And therefore, we do use tort law and other things to control that extreme behavior. And I think that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about covering 95% of speech. We're trying to cover talking about the extreme speech on one side where there's falsehood about people in a way that's harming their employment and emotional well-being. And maybe we could even turn that into my net gain, net loss thing. It's just unlikely that people make a career of running around saying what a great guy I am when it isn't true, and therefore we try to control the negative extreme.
But I think there are two general features about the virtual world that trouble me, or at least that I think we need to keep an eye on. And one is the complete disconnect between the real person and the person that's on the internet. I've talked about this before, but so if Saul has a bad day in the classroom and somebody makes fun of him, nonetheless, he's there and he's going to give his brilliant lectures all the time, and people quickly come to see the whole picture. and it won't be disconnected from who he is. Whereas in the virtual world, well, there's just no way of bringing this into relationship with the real person. The person just isn't there to do the correcting. And then, I mean, connected to that is this idea of disproportionality. In some of the stories that Dan Sokolov tells, for example, one tiny thing from a person's life becomes the whole reality about them. So the woman whose dog was on the train and did a mess and she didn't clean it up, all over the world, she's now the dog poop woman, and that's who she is. It's just one tiny part of one day in her life becomes the whole reality of who she is. And that, again, is a difference, because in the real world,
that
doesn't
bother me. Why does that bother you? So, I mean, it is a good term. Let's say it was a non-virtual world, and the reporter for the New York Times took a picture and wrote an article about this poop on the train in public. The woman didn't clear up. It's true. It's not defamatory. The story will go around the world a little bit. Let it discourage people from leaving a mess on the subway. Now, you might think it's unfortunate. This is a fine woman who does other good acts. She's free to go out there and try to do good deeds and become Mother Teresa. And the New York Times will also write articles about her. I'm not so worried about that. I don't like his examples, actually. I think that those are real examples about people. What worries me more is when they call someone the poop woman who's never been anywhere near the problem in her life. It's the falsehood spreading that bothers
me. Well, of course, that's worse. But I think the other kind of thing, to make a whole person seem to be about something that's actually tiny, is also bad. And
but we don't mind when they do a good thing. I mean, when they spread all over the world some good deed. I once helped a blind person cross the street. You'd think I was a saint the way they write an article about it.
I mean, do you know what I actually do? I don't let videotapes of me be put on the internet if I can possibly avoid it, because I know what happens is people take one uncharacteristic expression. It might be a moment when I have my eyes closed or something, and then they plaster that all over the place as my picture. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is my picture, because it's not characteristic, and people are very good.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, characteristic and using it as the characteristic.
Well, that explains our difference of reaction, because an unattractive person like me, I'm happy randomly for them to put a picture on the internet, because it usually improves my appearance.
But, you know, you can't control it, really. But I guess the thing is that usually when we select a picture, we look for one that's flattering, but more generally for one that's characteristic, that shows the whole person or shows something that expresses who we are. But what can happen on the internet so easily is that something that's totally uncharacteristic can define your identity for all of the future.
Yeah, that's an irony, isn't it, about the internet? So I think about Facebook, which is so much about self-presentation. Mm-hmm. So Facebook is biased towards what you just described, that people work very, very hard to construct their resume, their virtual resume, as it were. And the irony is that, meanwhile, there are people who can say, photograph, and spread really negative things about you, albeit not on Facebook, but elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so the internet really, it dichotomizes the world a little bit more.
Yeah, that's true.
And yet, it's as you mentioned these points, Saul and Martha, and I, we're looking at about 15 minutes left, and so I do want to ask you this, because both of you have made mention of it. Martha, you made mention of it explicitly. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, to many cyber law scholars, is the quintessential example of not only a cyber law but a successful one. And indeed, as you know, there have been symposia recently around Section 230, and it's certainly not without its critics, and that's what I want to get into here. And I'll frame it this way. One of the major points, in at least argued in favor of Section 230, is that its ability to insulate internet access providers, internet service providers, from the kinds of tort actions like defamation that would otherwise be brought against them if they didn't have that insulation, which is different than the physical world, than traditional print media, for example, you would not have these entities that give rise to speech, both good and dangerous. So I'm curious about both of you, Martha, and I'll start with you, since I know you mentioned explicitly, to get your perspective on eliminating Section 230, or short of that, reining it in. What is your overall view of Section 230 in terms of that potential risk and impact?
Well, I think we have to remember that we have had in the past anyway, a pretty good, robust regime of print media, where there still is legal liability. So if I send a letter to the New York Times that defames someone, and for some peculiar reason they choose to print it, they are liable as well as me. And yet it hasn't stopped the circulation of information, and it hasn't stopped inquiry into public life and so on. So I think that should be the starting point. Then we can think, what's different about the Internet? Why should the Internet providers get more protection? Well, I think a big entity like Google, it would be ridiculous to suppose they should monitor everything. And so for them to be liable for lawsuits might not be the right solution. Maybe for them, some sort of regime of notice and takedown, such as intellectual property, would be the right solution. But for a website owner, such as the guy who ran AutoAdmin, for that guy not to have any kind of legal liability analogous to the editors and publishers of the New York Times, let's say, I think that's a mistake. And so I guess I would rather break it down along those lines. But what do you think?
Well, I think the law is not bad. I mean, it's hard. It's a great question, Dave. I mean, it gets to the core of tort law, right? So sometimes we are quite comfortable holding somebody responsible who's not the direct wrongdoer because we think they're just in a better position to solve the problem. So, you know, going back to, you know, you get a car and the dealer did something wrong, we've come to accept the fact that maybe General Motors is responsible for the car. There are other settings. We might even, in some countries, think you're responsible for not rescuing somebody else or for holding a hospital responsible for what a nurse did. And, of course, we don't think the hospital board really did anything wrong. It's just we have trouble taking care of each individual nurse and doctor, and so we step back a little bit and try to find an entity that's easier to sue, that could in theory exercise control over these underlings, though sometimes the hospital cannot do so, and we get comfortable with that. But it's always a difficult question. I mean, it never occurs to anybody to hold the post office itself liable for defamatory things sent in the mail. Mm-hmm. You could think of that as an equivalent to Section 230. And on the other hand, sometimes the technology runs the other way. So, for example, the drift of modern copyright law is to start thinking that if YouTube is really good at searching materials, then maybe either holding YouTube responsible for copyrighted material that's shown without license on its site, or making it easy for Verizon or somebody else to do a search and then ask YouTube to take it down. We think that evolution of Section 230 really makes a lot of sense. And that's moving along with copyright law, 1008 and elsewhere, copyright law for listeners who are accustomed to thinking about this material. Mm-hmm. So I like the way law is moving this way, thinking hard about at least the second and third best cost avoiders, but not going too fast, thinking about how notice and takedown works and sending back responses and so forth. I'm quite comfortable with it. You know, the book Medium is a good example because it doesn't occur to us to hold Barnes & Noble responsible if it turns out that some book on its shelf violates copyright law or violates defamation law or elsewhere. Again, that's because we think the New York Times is more likely to be in good control of the letters to the editor than we think that it makes sense for the bookseller to have to read all the books on its shelf and figure out what's in there. So I think law has really moved quite sensibly in this, and in the case of the virtual world, it'll just depend on who has a better search mechanism for finding words like slut when they're inappropriately used, or for finding copyrighted material and so forth.
See, I think that the way it's evolved reflects a focus on political speech, and that's not bad. I mean, I think it's very important to focus on the freedom of political speech and therefore the opportunities of dissidents to say things that would be targeted and that would be the object of lawsuits. And we do know that there are countries where people who criticize the government can be sued for libel. That's happened in Singapore, for example, that professors who criticize the government in a class have been sued for libel. So I think it's not wrong for the people who craft law in this area to be very sensitive to that kind of issue and to bend over backwards to protect free political speech. But look, our free speech law has evolved in a way that gives political speech an especially high level of protection, and that has always said that there are other kinds of speech that are of less value, including things like bribery, perjury, unlicensed medical advice, misleading advertising. So once we study the history of the First Amendment, we recognize that we are capable of operating with distinctions between high-value speech and low-value speech. And there's no way that one could defend the idea that a threat against Jane Doe that's obscene is the same kind of speech as political speech criticizing the government. So no, I think we just have to be confident that we can make these distinctions and operate with them without sacrificing the freedom of political speech.
We're chatting with Professor Saul Levmar and Martha Nussbaum, both contributors and co-editors of the book The Offensive Internet, Speech Privacy and Reputation, on KJCO-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, in the remaining seven, eight minutes that we have, I want to focus on this harm aspect, which again, both of you write about in the context of Saul and anonymity, and as you mentioned earlier, Martha, with regard to women and misogynistic portrayals and treatment ultimately on the internet. And I'm curious, from a remedy standpoint, this sounds like a legalistic question, but I think it's a very practical one as well. How do you feel the internet, does the internet adequately remedy these problems? Now, we have the issues that we've discussed, but, you know, Juicy Campus and AutoAdmit are both gone. There is a market effect where at the same time that one can say something which is offensive, defamatory, or worse, a greater number of people perhaps can criticize that statement and therefore in some way rebuild or at least respond to an impact on reputation or worse. Do you feel, again, that the internet itself has built into it an ability to remedy these harms as a general matter or specifically?
I like the general evolution. Again, let's do the general case first. I think exactly as you say, the market works on the internet. So if you are one of the tens of millions of people who plays World of Warcraft or something, you find out that you can't just freely use the F word and other things on World of Warcraft and you're chatting at the bottom. That it's a market that's designed for people who want to play that silly game. And if you're just there giving offense to other people, they remove your account or they penalize you in various ways, just as if you had used counterfeit points and the like. There probably are games out there for the small audience that wants to use the F word all the time, and the market develops for them. Again, all those participants are voluntary. So, and of course, it's great that Juicy Campus was evolved out of existence and so forth. Notice, ironically, that that requires a non-zero marginal cost of transmission. It's because it costs something to be Juicy Campus. The Juicy Campus has evolved out. If server time and other things, you know, went down to zero, the Juicy Campuses of the world would last a longer time. But that doesn't stop the fact that Martha is right at the fringe. There, however big the internet is and however wonderful it is in 98% of its locations, so to speak, there'll be 2% of the locations where there are people saying horrible things about real people who really are wounded and not even in a very idiosyncratic way. I mean, there are really horrible things, you know, we could say about you and you could say about us that would resonate with many listeners. You know, people, some people who do harm are very, very good at committing harm. You know, if I sit here and I accuse Martha of stealing a certain amount of money for me on Thanksgiving morning when nobody was looking for my car and I have a picture of it. I mean, I can make this accusation sound really, really convincing. And that may just be 2% of the world, but I don't think it's so strange to think that there should be some remedy in that corner of the world.
Right. And I think the old canard that more speech, the remedy for bad speech is more speech, is not entirely adequate in this kind of case, because when those Yale women were defamed and these stories were spread about them, if it had just been possible for them to go on AutoAdmit and say, hey, this isn't true, this is who I am, I'm a really nice person and a good law student, that doesn't remove the harm, because there's a taint that hangs around that person just from the very fact that the accusation is made. And, you know, often when people are accused in some way falsely, people don't remember how it all came out and whether the charge was proven false. They just remember the charge, and they associate the person with that false charge.
I mean, sometimes the way to think about this is to depersonalize it and just imagine a really clever defamation of a product by a competitor. I mean, if we imagine one car company, one computer maker getting on the internet and beginning to spread information about how, you know, their X computer, Model 1000, caught on fire and everybody should be really careful. And they were determined and they spread this information around and the sales of the X1000 model went way down. Of course, everybody would think there should be a remedy to it. we would see this as an anti-competitive move by a computer maker. And unless word got out about who the home address was and who was spreading this malicious lie, you know, it would be very inefficient. You'd have a lot of businesses out there defaming their competitors rather than spending their energy building better computers and the like. So I don't think that, you know, it happens that it comes to our attention because people might care more about the world of feminism than they care about the world of commerce or something. But I think if this arose in a non-personal way, the solution to us would be obvious and law would move right along.
But in the end, I think this isn't just about law. And where I end up in my paper is saying, in the end of the day, it's the culture of gender in America. There's a lot of research about teenage boys in America and their attitudes toward women. You know, a lot of reason to think that we're in some crucial ways a misogynistic culture. And so we're never going to get rid of the problem without changing the way we bring up children, changing the gender roles that we present to them, and, of course, changing the peer culture insofar as we can. I mean, that's the thing. And even well-intentioned parents can't stop this from happening, because once kids go into the peer culture, then these misogynistic views can take hold. So I guess I think large-scale cultural change is the only thing that would really be an effective remedy.
Yeah, we cannot imagine a classroom, public school or private school, where an eighth-grade boy would be allowed to scream horribly racist and personally sexist things out about other people. Mm-hmm. We expect the teacher to discipline the child. The child might be removed from the school. The parents would be called in and so forth. So presumably when we say to our children, when you shout even louder on the internet, you also need to think about what you're saying and control it. Now, it might well be that the world, I'm not a mental health professional, but it might be that it's a healthy thing to create some space, maybe underwater in a swimming pool, maybe in a closet at home, where the boy who needs to scream out horrible things about women can go scream it out and get at us. I don't know. I would not like my children to do that. But I suppose if it's some physiological or mental need, that's fine, or it could be fine. But just because the internet exists doesn't mean that the internet has to be a place where people can scream these things, when we would not let them scream it in a local coffee shop, and we certainly wouldn't let them scream it in a classroom right in their classmate's face.
Professor Saul Livmore and Martha Nussbaum, co-editors and contributors to the book The Offensive Internet, Speech, Privacy, and Reputation. Thank you for much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I mean, certainly this is a fascinating discussion. As you've invited me, I too will invite you back on Hearsay Culture to continue this conversation, but I appreciate you taking the time today to share these thoughts with my listeners, and particularly for producing this volume, which I found very insightful. And as I mentioned, I'm a fan of your work as well as the authors that are here. So thank you for joining us today on the show.
Well, thank you so much. We're a fan of your show, and thank you to your listeners for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dave, and thanks to all the listeners.
My pleasure. I'm excited to mention one last guest coming up on Hearsay Culture before we go into the interim period. But next week, and an appropriate follow-up to our conversation today, Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University will be on discussing her book, Privacy in Context. And then we are going to be in the interim period on KZSU, where there will not be new shows airing, but new shows will begin airing at the beginning of the winter quarter, which occurs at the end of December, beginning of January. And among the guests that I have booked for next quarter are Professor George Contreras of American University Washington College of Law, Baron Zelka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra, Andrew Renz, research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School, Jeremy Zimmerman of the French advocacy organization La Quadrature du Net, Professor Daniel Margoxi of Hunter College, co-editor of States of Secrecy, a forthcoming volume of the British Journal of the History of Science, and Professor John McGinnis of Northwestern University Law School, author of the forthcoming book, Accelerating Democracy. I'm also in the process of booking other guests for the winter, so if you have any suggestions for future guests on the show, please let me know by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to to Hearsay Culture. You can email, you can listen first and foremost live on KZSU Thursdays from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time by streaming kzsulive.stanford.edu or by listening in the Bay Area. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School's iTunes page, as well as our website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And you can also get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you will get all previous shows as well as the schedule and occasional blog entries. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback, suggestions for future guests at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.